Oh, our friends at ButcherBox, everybody, they're offering juicy, flavorful, grill-ready, 100% grass-fed beef burgers, perfect for any summer cookout. ButcherBox burgers are ready to go. Third of a pound patties that can be simply tossed on the grill. I'm telling you, I use them all the time. I love them, love them, love them. I get so excited when I get my ButcherBox supply. Choose from four curated boxes, including a mix of high-quality grass-finished beef, free-range organic chicken, heritage breed pork, or customize your own box so you get exactly what you and your family needs. ButcherBox believes in a healthier food system where everyone has access to meat the way nature intended it, free of antibiotics, free of adulterated hormones. Sockeye salmon, of course, that sockeye salmon, they source it at ButcherBox. Pure, wild, sustainable harvest salmon from the Bristol Bay, Alaska. It is convenient. It is affordable. And for $20 off your first box and a package of six burgers for free in every box all summer long until October 15th, go to butcherbox.com/Drew. Again, butcherbox.com/DREW, or just enter promo code Drew at checkout. I promise you, you will not be sorry. Go to butcherbox.com/Drew. And welcome to the Dr. Drew podcast. Keep wins in the sale of the Corolla pilot ship. Support the people that support us. I'm not going to spend a lot of time pimping you guys out today because I'm very excited about our current guest, Sean Carroll. He is a research professor of physics at Caltech. His podcast, which I'm a huge fan, is called Mindscape. His forthcoming book is Something Deeply Hidden, Quantum Worlds and the Emergence of Space-Time. We're going to have to get a little bit into that if you don't mind.
I'll explain it, yeah.
Yeah. You just finished a pod where you were sort of interviewed.
That's right.
On this very topic, essentially. And I was fascinated by your many worlds position and all the different I don't have in my head all the different controversies that you guys milled through, but I would love if you would share some of that with my listeners. I want to get into a lot of stuff. You can follow Dr. Carroll, yes,
Sean,
Sean at Sean M. Carroll, CARROLL. His training is PhD in astronomy in from Harvard, a dissertation on cosmological consequences of topological and geometric phenomenon and field theories. Good times.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping to make this digestible for everybody. And I love your podcast. I found it probably about 6 months ago, and I've just been pouring through it. And I just – last week I finally caved in and said, hey, please get Dr. Carroll and Sean. And I know you're right over the road here in Caltech. I went to Polytechnic right across the street.
Okay, yeah, sure.
So do my kids go there. I have lots of friends at Caltech. I went to Amherst College, and so we're lots of crossover in these science worlds. But not everyone can digest a podcast like Mindscape, My Fear, even though I think everyone should. You know what I mean? It's accessible as hell, but I thought I'm going to expose my audience to your stuff and see if they really want to get into it, and then they'll head on over to yours.
I would say that there are some episodes everyone can just easily digest. Every episode I think you can get something out of if you're willing to think about it.
You got to pay attention. And not everyone has that same
mechanism.
Don't
want to play it at 2x speed.
Many times. So one of the things that gets very complicated very quickly is the quantum world.
Yeah.
Give a little primer, and I'll try to help guide you along the way because it's a huge landscape. We start with Newtonian physics.
Yeah. So quantum physics is what happened after we had Newtonian physics. Okay.
Right.
So since the 1600s, people basically thought that Isaac Newton had the rules figured out.
Right. We just needed to get it down to the final decimal place.
Our job was some details, right? And Newtonian physics says, let's say you have a baseball. It has a position. It has a velocity. Yeah. There are forces acting on it. That's all that there is.
And if you knew the position, the velocity of everything, you would know everything.
You could say where the baseball is going to go. And in fact, that clearly seems to be true. Like outfielders can catch baseballs when they see them flying through the air. Quantum mechanics had to come along in the early 1900s because this Newtonian physics idea was completely incompatible with what we were observing about atoms and the particles inside atoms, electrons and photons and so forth.
Right.
So for example, we
certainly first started with this idea of like electrons flying around like planets around the nucleus.
You've all seen these little pictures like the solar system where there's a nucleus in the middle, an electron going around. And if you apply the rules of Newtonian classical mechanics to that little electron zooming to beat the band, the electron should be giving off light. That's what light is. All the light in this room comes from an electron bouncing up and down, right? And so if these electrons are zooming around in orbits, they should give off light, they should lose energy, and they should fall into the nucleus at the center of the atom.
Based on the math as we knew it at the time.
Based on classical mechanics, based on the best physics we had. So like every table – every person, the Earth, would all just collapse into a black hole in a tiny fraction of a second.
But if Newtonian physics was to tell the whole story.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. So you had to come up with something different. And long story short, because it is a long and fascinating story.
Yeah, and multiple colorful personalities involved along the way.
So yeah, exactly. I mean, Einstein gets actually a bad rep. I think Einstein is underrated, if anything, as a physicist. He was even smarter than people give him credit for. But the idea that we eventually settled on was there's this way of describing an electron or anything else in the world. But when you observe the electron, when you look at it, you do not see what it is. These things that Newton had in mind, like the position and the velocity, that's what you see when you look. You can measure the position. But when the electron isn't being looked at, it doesn't have a position. It has a quantum state, a wave function, whatever you want to call it, but that's something that we can use to calculate the probability that you will observe different positions, but there's no such thing as what position it actually has.
And that's why we had electron clouds.
There's a cloud of it, right. So the electron is most likely to be seen near the nucleus, less and less likely further away, and that's happily where it's living until you look at it and then you see it somewhere. And of course, this drives people crazy because, like, what do you mean look at it? What counts as looking at it?
And by the way, they tried other things like essentially directing a camera at it, or if it's observed in any way.
That's right.
You've done something to it.
That's right. But the embarrassment is the following, that quantum mechanics is far and away the most successful theory ever in the history of physics.
It predicts everything we need to predict.
It does everything that we've ever experimentally observed is compatible with quantum mechanics, and yet we don't understand it.
Our brain can't quite handle it.
No, it's not that our brain can't quite handle it. It's that we haven't tried to understand it.
So that's one of the scandals. Is that
yes,
people,
that's the scandal.
Is that people just go, don't worry about it.
Exactly.
Just start applying
it. Don't ask questions.
Don't ask questions.
Yeah,
and now people
shut
are,
up and calculate.
Now people are starting to ask questions about it.
There were always a plucky band of rebels who would ask questions, but it's beginning to become a bit more respectable. And so even though in the upcoming book I push my favorite version of quantum mechanics, what's much more important to me is that we care about trying to understand it.
Talk about particle versus wave for a second.
Well, there's a whole bunch of things one can say about that. The
yes.
short version, once again, is the world is made of waves. The world is made of fields, as we say. So a wave is just a field that is vibrating. A field is the opposite of a particle. A particle has a location. There it is. It's a point, right? A field is everywhere. Like the electric field has a value at every point in space. And that value might be zero, but there's still an essence, a thing, the electric field. And when you set it vibrating, you can see that that's what light is. Light is a vibration in the electric and magnetic fields. But when you look closely enough at these vibrating fields, they appear to us as particles. So this is the over and over again the mystery of quantum mechanics is what you see is not what there is. So what there is, what makes up the world are fields vibrating and interacting with each other. What you see when you look at them closely enough are individual particle-like things.
And the many worlds theory?
So let's say we look at an electron. It's a cloud before we look at it, a wave function, and we don't know what we're going to see. And so there is this always been this weird problem like, you know, what counts as an observation, et cetera. So many worlds says the following, like forget about all this weird talk about measurement and observation. Just that's wrong. It was just going down a wrong track to begin with. The trick is that you are a quantum mechanical system also, not just the electron. So just like the electron has a cloud of probability that describes what it's doing, so do you.
So I am a cloud of probability that's describing everything.
Yeah, that's right.
But is you observing me changing me?
Yeah, absolutely. And you
observe. So every time you look at me, there's many worlds?
Well, because we're big.
Or you have to measure me.
Interestingly, the precision with which something is localized in space is higher for big things than for small things. The smaller something gets, the more fuzzed out it is. Mm. So you and I more or
is
less –
is that a function of our ability and our technologies?
None of this has anything to do with our abilities,
technology,
experiment.
It's just a function
experiment.
Of –
it's how reality works.
The function of smallness.
That's right. And that's why it took so long for quantum mechanics to be discovered. For – you know, if you want to fly a rocket to the moon, you don't need quantum mechanics. You know,
yeah.
Newtonian physics works perfectly well. So many worlds says the following. The reason why you're mystified by measuring a quantum electron is because when you look at it, it's not that now before the electron was all spread out and afterwards it's in a point. There is a world where the electron is located here and you saw it there.
That's one.
There's another world
yes.
where the electron was located somewhere else and you saw it that other place and so on for every single place it could be seen.
Is it – this is the part that I started
I hope so.
Musing about.
Yeah.
Is it infinite worlds within the cloud?
you know, here's how embarrassing it is. We don't know.
So at least they're approaching
a lot
of worlds, of potential worlds, and all exist.
Let's put it this way.
Do they all exist?
Yeah, they do. That's what Many Worlds says.
Yeah. So every observation of every point of that electron in that cloud is a world.
That's right. It creates a world. The world branches. The single world that was there before you looked at it branches into multiple copies that are all exactly the same, except in each one of them you saw the electron in a slightly different place.
Is it only when we interact with electrons?
It is whenever a big classical system interacts with a small quantum system.
Yeah. And interacts with – how come I'm not interacting with it now?
Well, you are, but everything is so closely localized already because it's a big macroscopic thing that you don't notice.
So right? Are there billions of worlds happening right now?
Well, there are, because in your body there are, roughly speaking, 5,000 radioactive decays per second.
Right.
So every one of those radioactive decays splits
the world.
Universe.
So I'm having 5,000 worlds per second.
Sadly, no. You're having 2^5,000.
And then there's
every one of those 5,000 splits the world in two. So it's
right.
2 × 2 × 2 × 2 × 5,000.
And then
5,000
you mentioned times. There's another world in which it's 10^2^5,000.
Well, the total number, we don't know if it's infinite or finite, but we know that it's really super duper big.
And as you approach infinity, right? As you approach infinity, doesn't it sort of collapse into one?
Because I don't know what that means.
There's infinity between one and two. If it's an open set, as opposed to a bracketed set, how come this isn't just an infinite number of worlds that exist as the set of 0 to 1?
Because we don't have a language for this.
Yeah,
well.
I mean, and I'm not a mathematician. My son is, and so I have tried to have these conversations with him. So
yeah, it's a fascinating mathematical fact that when you study the real number line, right, numbers like 0.1, 1/√3, etc., there are an infinite number of numbers between 0 and 1. That's a fascinating mathematical and between any two numbers. So there's the same number of numbers between 0 and 1 as there are from minus infinity to infinity. This is just how weird math is. But math is different than physics. Math is, in some sense, is about every possible world you can imagine. Physics is about the one actual universe in which we live.
When you were – I feel like I'm not doing your many worlds justice thus far. But when you were describing in the podcast, people can go to your podcast and get a really careful layout of all the different – scandals in physics that came between 1900 and now, essentially. I started thinking to myself, maybe we just don't know what waves and fields really are. Maybe we really just don't understand that.
Yeah, that's perfectly good. We don't. So it's one of my big messages in the book is not only we don't understand quantum mechanics and should try harder, but that trying harder matters for the rest of physics. Like we have this long-standing puzzle how to fit gravity into the quantum mechanical umbrella. All the other forces of nature and all the other pieces of matter are perfectly quantum mechanical. That's how we describe them. It all works. Gravity doesn't seem to fit. And I think that
– And gravity is a wave.
Classically,
sort of.
It is. In the classical version, general relativity, that's Einstein's theory of gravity. Yeah, quantum gravity, we don't know what it is. And I think in some sense, why in the world should we expect to be able to understand quantum gravity if we don't understand quantum mechanics?
Right.
Which quantum gravity is just part of.
It just feels, you know, listening to all the different scandals, to controversies in physics, it just feels Keplerian to me. It feels like epicycles. It just feels like people going, oh, I got a solution to this, and they work, but they feel like epicycles to me.
That's what it is like when you don't know what the final answer is, right? You have lots of different possibilities.
Yeah.
None of them is perfect. Otherwise, we would drop the other ones, right?
Yeah.
None of them is completely off track. Otherwise, we wouldn't pay attention to them.
When they work, we stay with them.
Yeah, we
when they're an approximation of reality, we stay with them.
In theoretical physics, when you have lots of ideas and don't know which one is true, different people will judge the relative likelihood, the relative promise of different theories differently. That's why there are controversies.
Well, right? The way you described all the controversies, I started thinking, geez, everyone has its own sort of psychologically gratifying qualities
about
it.
And so
your personality drives you to it.
Yeah,
which is not the way physics is supposed to be done.
No, it's exactly how physics has to be done.
Really?
Because we're making educated guesses about what is true even though we don't know for sure. So you have to say, well, I don't know for sure. I keep an open mind. But still, I think the most likely thing is this. Otherwise, you don't know what to do. You don't know what to work on. You don't know what ideas to spend time thinking about.
Anything more in the book that we want to go over before I move to another topic?
Oh, the book. So, I mean, the book, Something Deeply Hidden, coming out September 10th, is about, number one, we try to explain quantum mechanics. Number two, I try to give the sales pitch for many worlds, including, you know, wondering about, well, where does all the energy come from? Are there moral implications? Are there implications?
Energy in the universe?
Yeah, if the universe splits in two, doesn't that cost twice as much energy? You know, read the book to find out. No, it doesn't. It really doesn't.
Okay, great.
And then the third message is, you know, gravity, how quantum gravity, how the emergence of space-time might work in this picture. So how
In the many worlds picture.
In the many worlds picture, yeah.
Do you analyze any of the other ones?
Three dimensions.
What are some of the other
– I mentioned them.
What are some of the other ones?
Only disparaging.
Yeah. The Copenhagen whatever.
So the standard – interpretation of quantum mechanics is the Copenhagen interpretation.
Yeah.
And I don't even like the word interpretation because these are really different physical theories. And the Copenhagen interpretation is just denial. It's just saying, don't ask me what really happens.
They have a little theory though, don't they? Or they had some personalities attached to it.
Oh, yeah. No, there were brilliant people who thought about this and they came up with it and it was perfectly respectable at the time, but now we should and can do much better. There are hidden variable theories. So there are still people out there who think that particles do have positions over and above this cloud of probability that we talk about.
We just can't find it. We can't figure out how to find it.
Well, we don't – you know, we – it's a weird thing. It's a very bizarre theory, but it's compatible with the data so far where you have both this wave function, this fuzzy cloud, and you have a location of the particle. The wave function pushes around the particle, but the particle doesn't push back. So just by looking at wave functions, we can't tell what the particles are doing. Until we observe them, we don't know where they are. And that's why hidden variable theories are a little unpalatable to physicists. Like we have this rule that actions cause equal and opposite reactions and hidden variable theories violate
that. But there's lots of things in quantum mechanics that violates
absolutely
you know,
true. This is where your taste comes in,
yeah,
right? This is where,
right.
Well, what are you going to give up on? You're going to give up on something.
I like that one.
And
see, what's it about
there
my personality?
You and Einstein. You're on Einstein's
okay,
side.
Okay, good. That's
you like
good.
That
good
too.
Team to be on.
And there's another one that says that, you know, small quantum systems have a random chance of just popping from being all spread out to being completely localized, you know, once every few million years.
Just okay? Like laws of entropy.
Completely,
like,
yeah.
Like it's sort of an entropy.
Completely unpredictably.
I mean, all of oxygen in this room could suddenly – has a probability of suddenly ending up in the corner.
It's a little bit different though because that probability is just because you and I don't know exactly what the molecules are doing right now. So we give a probability. But if you were classical Newtonian, you would be able to in principle say exactly what the molecules are going to do. This dynamical collapse version of quantum mechanics says even in principle – you don't know what's going to happen next.
Right.
And it happens very, very rarely for individual particles. But when you put a whole bunch of particles together, that's why they tend to stick into one classical place.
In addition to lack of really, really penetrating waves, I also am always concerned when we talk about probabilities, the human.
Good.
Because
another thing we don't understand very well.
Humans don't assess very well. We don't understand really what we're talking about.
Most human beings think that there are only three probabilities, 0, 1, and 50%, right?
Yeah, right.
Like, if you say like there's a 70% chance of something, they like, oh, so it's going to happen, right?
Right. Well, there was a 30% chance that Donald Trump was going to win the election
exactly.
or something
that's
like that.
That's right. And people thought, okay, then
that's zero.
He's not going to win.
That
yeah,
is
exactly.
zero.
Right. So and so that's psychologically that's hard to deal with, but also
– that's more than psychological. That's a function of the instrument, I think, our brain.
I think so. I think it's you know, one of these heuristics mm-hmm. that it's easier for us to think certainty or uncertainty.
Well, you're used to thinking in terms of probabilities too, remember. And,
yeah.
And I – you know, I'm a biologist. And I see the whole thing as a giant probability
right.
equation. But
that's
when
right.
I talk to people about it, they just don't seem to – they want to talk about linear –
well, playing poker is a good way to educate yourself to think more accurately about probabilities.
Yes. People still have way magical thinking around poker and gambling.
They do, and I like to play with them. Yes.
You want to interview what's Duke's first name? The twins. Her name, last name is Duke. She's
Annie Duke.
Annie Duke. Have you interviewed her for your podcast?
No, I've interviewed Liv Boree, who is a
Annie would be a great interview for
player.
You.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it's very educational. But even at the like rigorous academic level, we don't understand what probability is.
Okay? No, we don't. We have – that's another thing. I think like to me these are the areas I wish physics and theoreticians were focusing on. What is a wave? What is a field?
Well,
what is probability? What really is it? We have not penetrated it yet.
Part of the problem with this denial that we have about quantum mechanics is part of – it comes from the fact that we don't want to mix physics and philosophy. That's just been a traditional thing. In the 20th century, we haven't done that.
That seems like you're scratching that itch all the time.
I do it. Yeah. I think it's crazy. But – and it wasn't always true. It basically happened – the center of physics moved from Europe to the U.S. in the 1940s. And Americans just don't have patience for all these abstract philosophizing things.
Right, like we're too pragmatic.
Yeah, if you're like Niels Bohr, Albert Einstein, Schrodinger, these people were heavily steeped in philosophy and literature and culture. And then you know the Richard Feynmans of the world are like, bah, we don't need to think about that.
Why waste our time?
Yeah,
but well, philosophy was the science.
That's where science came from.
That's it. I mean, psychology was.
But nowadays, you know, we have science and philosophy as separate disciplines, but philosophy is still really good at this sort of conceptual analysis where you say, well, what is a field really? And a physicist is going to say, like, oh, come on. They're going to roll their eyes.
Well,
like, don't ask that.
But you could sort of, I don't know, I feel like it's the way Einstein was thinking about special relativity and general relativity. He would have these models in his head of elevators and people moving. That we need something like that for our brain really to get fields.
It
took him to come up with that.
It's a fascinating question about how the actual biology or neuroscience of our brain helps us and hinders us in being physicists, right?
Of course. That's the instrument you're using. It's like
exactly. But on the one hand, we know more about physics than anything else. We know way more about physics than we know about biology. In some sense, physics is the simplest, easiest science, right? But nevertheless, it has pushed us into regimes that seem bizarre and counterintuitive to our everyday experience.
I don't quite understand that.
Well, we're forced to invent things like relativity and quantum mechanics and the Big Bang because the data we collect in our telescopes and microscopes forces it on us.
Shows it to us.
But the point is we never would have imagined it ahead of time.
Right. Well, that's what science
is. It's very counter to our expectations.
That's why the Baconian Revolution is about evidence.
Yep.
And that's what the general population doesn't get. You have to have evidence to develop your thought.
But you also have an idea to test, right? You need to have a hypothesis and then you go out and test it.
Yes.
And the part of the Baconian scientific method that never was a well-defined algorithm was invent a hypothesis.
What does that
That's
mean?
That's somewhat magical, right?
Yeah.
We don't know how we do that. We don't know how to do it better. People who are good at it, like Einstein, are amazing. We would all love to be able to understand where those hypotheses come from in our brains.
That's another – to me, that feels like waves. That's another – you know what I mean? It's another interesting thing to penetrate that we just haven't penetrated yet.
Yeah.
That's fascinating to me. And a lot of people don't even know what – we're talking about the scientific method, which is come up with a hypothesis, come up with an experiment to test it, do some sort of statistical analysis to see what the probability of that test proved or did not prove. I was raised on the null hypothesis. I feel like they're not doing that anymore. Is there a reason for that?
I'm not sure what they're doing. I think, we're better at it a little bit these days. We're Bayesian. Have you read about that?
Yeah.
So I think that
it's messier.
I think the right way to do it is to admit that for anything that you might imagine is true, there's a probability that you should assign. Is it 50% likely to be true? Is it 0.0001% likely to be true, et cetera? And then what you do is you go out and learn more things. You collect information about the world and you update. You change all your probabilities.
Reproduce.
Yeah,
which is
more compatible with our
The p-binding guesses. Today is concerning me greatly. The biological sciences are going a little weird. They really
are. I actually think it's very healthy. I think biologists have way more data now than they used to.
Oh, my God. And they have ways of analyzing it they couldn't.
And they have ways of analyzing it. And therefore, they're able to be more rigorous than they used to be, but they're not trained to be more rigorous yet. So I think it's happening. I think it's all good, all healthy. It's all very natural.
Okay, because at least on the medical side, there's a lot of funny business.
Well, we're not there yet. And psychology is much worse than medicine.
Yeah,
so that's why there's something called the replication crisis, people realizing that all of these wonderful psychological findings aren't there if you look again. Some of them are, but many of them aren't. And so we need to be a little bit more sophisticated in how we test hypotheses and think about their probabilities. Yeah.
And then you were interviewing somebody, I think, that maybe it was this last interview that did a time stamp on their hypothesis or something and then also put their p-value that they were going to be looking for in that time stamp. Was it your podcast?
I don't think that was mine, but that's the kind of thing that you should do. Yeah.
That is rarely done, right?
Right.
So you state what your hypothesis is before you test it. You put a – this is the p-value I'm looking for, and that's – you send it to yourself in the mail or something.
Yeah. Well, and there's a whole mess of things going on. Like let's say that you do an experiment and the null hypothesis is correct. In other words, you don't see any interesting effect. Then no one's going to publish your result, right?
That's the part that's screwing it up.
Well, yeah, money, jobs, prizes, prestige.
Money. Right,
I like jobs. Yeah,
money. Okay. Before we leave quantum mechanics, one of the most bizarre findings in all of it is the electron spin thing.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
So
here you have an electron. Electrons can spin exactly like the Earth or a spinning top or whatever, with one huge difference.
And that's what we do with MRIs.
Electron spin is not just a hypothetical bit of abstract nonsense.
We use it
nonsense.
To create energy. MRIs are giant magnets that line up all the spins let it go, and then they measure the energy that comes off, and they start going into their random spins.
That's right. But the thing is, when you measure an electron spin, you can measure it along some axis. So basically,
it's like the Earth.
Send
Earth has
it through,
an axis.
Well, it's not just like that, because the Earth has an axis. An electron, before you look at it, you're measuring it along an axis.
Okay, got it.
So you're pushing it through a magnetic field, and the electron, rather than sort of being sprayed all over in different directions depending on what the spin is, it only either gets deflected up or down. And that means it's either spinning clockwise with respect to the magnetic field or counterclockwise.
That's what determines –
only those two choices.
That's what determines the direction it goes.
The direction of the magnetic field determines which direction it goes.
Yeah.
And so that's weird. Like the Earth, you could imagine tilting its axis. You could imagine slowing it down, speeding it up, all sorts of different things. The electron only seems to be spinning clockwise or counterclockwise and always by exactly the same rate. Okay. So you say, well, what if I just rotated my – magnetic field and measure it along a different axis. Well, then the electron is only bounced left or right with respect to that axis. It's still only either clockwise or counterclockwise. And so you say, well, what was it doing before I measured it? And that's why you need to invent a quantum wave function. Yeah, it wasn't doing any of those things. That's only your measurement outcome is clockwise or counterclockwise, not what the electron was really doing.
And once you measure one, you know what the next one's going to be? Isn't that
how
that works?
Yeah, so once you've measured it, the wave function gives probabilities to every possible measurement outcome. If you didn't know what it was and you measured, okay, it's spinning clockwise. Now you know it's spinning clockwise. Now that's what the wave function
some
is.
Some electron
you measured. And if you keep measuring it over and over again along the same direction, it's going to be clockwise, clockwise, clockwise. But then if you measure it along a different direction, half clockwise, half counterclockwise.
If you like my show, you're going to love Mama Said with Jamie Sigler and Jenna Paris on the new Lady Gang Network on Podcast One. Join actress Jamie Lynn Sigler and musician Jenna Paris as they use their experience in motherhood to help you confess your mommy sins, realize you're not alone, and feel like you're killing the mommy game. Download Mama Said every week on Apple Podcast and at Podcast One. Okay, I want to tell you about BlueChew.com. They offer performance enhancement in the bedroom, right? I think people understand this. They are the same medication, chewable version of the active ingredients in Viagra and Cialis medications like that. It can work faster than pills because it's chewable. And again, BlueChew.com, it's taken on an empty stomach, as all these medicines should be. They give you an online physician consult for free. It's an actual licensed physician who evaluates you, make sure it's medically appropriate for you to be provided with this medication. It's, of course, cheaper than the other two medication, and the physician consult is essentially a toss-off. Only takes a few minutes to connect with BlueChew.com affiliated physician and get prescribed online quickly. This is an efficiency. This is where online medical care systems can provide a level of efficiency. And it's a very common problem. Men over 40 typically will start to experience some decline in function. And we now have these very safe, very effective medication, if appropriate, for you to prescribe. I myself have had a prostatectomy. These medications are good for guys like me. Good for any guy over 40, for that matter. There's no in-person doctor visit, no awkward conversation. This is all they're doing. They know what you're there for, and it is highly confidential and discreet with discreet packaging. They give you confidence. Here's a great deal for you guys. Visit BlueChew.com. Get your first order for free with promo code Drew, D-R-E-W, just paying $5 shipping. That is BlueChew.com, promo code Drew. 60 seconds, that is exactly how long it takes to get an offer to trade in your car with TrueCar, or get a cash offer or trade in for something new or used, whatever you like. That's right. The amount of time it takes me to read this thing, you could have a cash offer for your car or arrange a trade-in. Best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or home. You just go to TrueCar, simply enter your license plate number. Then you see how your car's details pop up, answer a couple questions. Then you get that accurate true cash offer from a local true car certified dealer. It's that easy. After that, you bring your car in, they check it out, you ask some questions, or they ask you some questions. No surprises. You can ask questions if you like as well. Then you leave with your check. It is just that easy. Or if you want to trade in, use TrueCar to look at the scattergram for a vehicle like the one you're interested in, whether it's new or used. Don't forget, they have used cars as well. Lock in that price. You know it's a true price, includes fees and accessories. You know it's for an actual vehicle on that TrueCar certified dealer's lot. And you know it's a fair price because you see what other people pay for the car you like in your area. Then, when you come in with your true cash offer, you simply trade in for your new ride. So, when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out True Car today. And there's some other characteristic where even if you took another electron on a distant planet, what would happen to that electron after you measure the first one?
So this
Isn't
is
how that works?
Yeah, this is the phenomenon of entanglement.
This is weird.
Crucially
this is
important.
So
this
crazy.
Is what, again, this is what bugged Einstein too. So you're in very good company. Given one electron, I don't know whether it's going to be clockwise or counterclockwise. Given two electrons, I don't know which either one of them are going to be for a random wave function. But there can be certain special wave functions which are entangled with the property that I don't know what any electron is going to be spin clockwise or counterclockwise. But I know that when I measure that electron, the other electron will have the same spin.
Wherever that electron
exists.
So
either they're both clockwise or they're both counterclockwise.
Even if I go measure that electron on Mercury.
And you can prepare this system right here in the lab and you can send one to Alpha Centauri 4 light-years away and then do your measurement and still right away the other one is settled in.
What is that?
And that's what Einstein called spooky action at a distance.
Yes.
And he worried about it.
It's very concerning.
Yeah.
And you got a theory? Is it a bunch of worlds attached to it?
Yeah, exactly. So what I would say is here when you measure your spin, the world splits in two and the electron very, very far away also splits in two with its different – there's two different worlds.
Why is it random which one I then encounter?
Well, it's not that it's random which one you encounter. It's that there are two copies of you. Each one of them encounters one.
But what determines that encounter? Why couldn't it be also be that next encounter be a little more?
Well, that's the entanglement. That's just a feature of quantum mechanics. That you know the worlds are not individually random piece by piece. They can be correlated with each other, so that when something happens here, it affects the whole world instantaneously.
The whole universe.
The world in the broadest sense. Yeah.
Yeah. And the Heisenberg principle in all this, which is the measurement part, or is there more to that?
The Heisenberg principle, remember I said, you know, you could imagine a wave function where you knew the electron was exactly spinning clockwise.
Yes.
But you can't have any wave function where you know what the electron spin is with respect to a vertical axis and what it is with respect to the horizontal axis at the same time.
And that's
– likewise, you could have an electron which was perfectly localized in position – but it cannot be localized in both position and velocity at the same time.
That was the original classical Heisenberg uncertainty
principle.
Yeah. I'm hoping you guys are all keeping up with this because this is the foundation of physics.
So, you know, I have my podcast Mindscape and I've had already a couple of episodes on quantum mechanics and I have two more coming up in the next couple months.
Oh, good. I can't
wait. I'm getting people excited about this.
So you guys got to go over there and hear the details. Tell me about your sense of – you know, Indris Viscontis was here and I spent the whole time talking about neuroscience. I didn't know until I heard your podcast how deeply involved in music she was. I thought it was just some epiphenomenon for her and it turns out, oh my god.
Opera singer, director.
Well, I knew that and she's so damn smart and was so impressive talking to her. We spent a lot of time talking about the insular cortex and she sort of opened a new world to me. But she mentioned something about your assessment of consciousness. And I wonder if you could share a little bit of that without
– Yeah. So my previous book, The Big Picture, was trying to explain to people that the world makes sense as a purely physical thing. Basically,
yes. So we're physical reductionists.
Yeah, exactly. We don't need – the word reductionist –
Essentialist. How about that?
You know, we're physicalists, if you want to put it that way.
Naturalist, you can explain everything based on what is.
So in other words, even consciousness does not seem some separate mental properties, does not need some separate mental
properties.
Right.
That's saying that when you draw a bow across a violin – the music that comes is related to the bow and the the density of air and whatnot, but I'll explain about what's in there.
So I go through things like the origin of the universe, the origin of life, the origin of consciousness, and none of these are things we know the answers to, okay? But I try to make the case that all of them are very plausibly just stuff obeying the laws of physics.
Sure.
You know, in more and more complicated ways. Well, you say sure, but most people in the world don't agree with you, right?
It's weird. That's weird to me.
It's not, obviously.
Because, you know, brain stuff, you were both, I think, last podcast talking about the difference between consciousness generated from transistors versus the brain stuff. But brain stuff is a special thing. I mean, if you just talk about one synapse, just the infinite complexity of how that one synapse is regulated and that there are hundreds and hundreds of trillions of these, that starts to get pretty interesting.
Well, it's very complicated. You know, I talk a lot in the book about C. elegans. Do you know C. elegans?
Oh, that's what all, it's a little all round worm neuroscience is based on.
Yeah. So this little guy has little gal, because they're the female ones we study. They're 302 neurons.
We know every synapse in that organism.
And we still don't know what they do, right?
We still don't understand it, yeah.
We know every one. We've mapped it out. We know what all the connections are.
We know some of the biology at the microscopic level too.
And that's not enough to sort of understand the functions.
In other words, we can't predict based on –
We can't say, well, if you turn off this neuron, what effect will that have? If this neuron fires, what happens?
Yeah. So – you can do some of that, but you can't describe the behavior.
Yeah. No, that's right. Yeah. And so to extrapolate from 302 to 85 billion that you and I have in our heads and say, well – we don't understand it yet. Of course we don't understand it.
And by the way, we're brain-centric. There's a spinal column with trillions and trillions. There's an autonomic nervous system that we're just beginning to look at.
That is a recurring theme on my podcast. I've talked to
– the autonomic system?
Well, the fact that the brain is embodied and thinking happens
brain is embodied
brain.
And bodies are embedded.
Yes.
And I think consciousness, humbly, is not a single skull event. Arousal and awareness and awakeness and focus on all this stuff is one skull. Consciousness emerges from having been experienced by other brains.
Could be.
It's very simple.
It's not very simple.
It's not very simple, but that phenomenology is simple. And that needs – we got to give up the single skull idea of consciousness and bring it back to two, because I just started thinking if we got to do more studies on feral children and stuff. When they emerge, there was that feral child in France that emerged from the woods at 13 after getting lost at age 2. Didn't have consciousness when it showed up. Didn't have language.
Is that fair? Do we know?
Had awareness and had all kinds of
– consciousness – so ordinarily we think of consciousness as sort of the inner experience.
It's awareness of awareness.
Right. Yeah, self-awareness.
It's this insular cortex thing.
The redness of red.
I'm telling you – well, that's the qualia stuff. But I think the insular cortex is going to have a very important role in all this.
How do you know that the feral child –
I don't know. You don't know. Maybe you couldn't communicate it. But I'm going to bet that if we started looking more carefully at that, you wouldn't see what we think of as awareness of awareness.
Or maybe
the primordium of it. But that it would emerge with relating to other humans,
right? I mean, I can be skeptical because no one knows. Yeah. But I am on your side in the sense that not only our bodies, but our social interactions, our social mosaics, are crucially important in determining who we are and how we think.
Well, the self emerges in a social matrix, right?
There you go.
Yeah. Why shouldn't the consciousness also emerge? and consciousness is probably a little more flimsy than it seems, than it feels.
Well, we lose it every night.
Right? And we easily lose it with certain medicines and things too. Yeah. It's probably not as robust as it feels.
And it has something to do with the wiring diagram in the brain and the fact that it's a small world network, the fact that it's not just a little lattice, but different parts of the brain can communicate with each other in different ways, because we do studies, and when you go to sleep or you're on drugs or you're anesthetized, that network sort of dissolves and local parts can talk to each other, but there's not this wide-scale coherence. So there's a lot of stuff going on to make consciousness, and the fact that we don't fully understand it right now is the least surprising thing in the world to me.
Yeah. I mean, Chalmers calls it the difficult problem. What's
hard problem.
The hard problem.
Yeah.
Are you in his camp? Or?
I'm not, but I had him on the podcast. it was a fun conversation.
Yeah. I was going to listen to it. I didn't because he frustrates me. But what did you take away from that?
Well, David is really smart, and I disagree with him about most things that we care about. He describes himself as a naturalist, so he doesn't believe in God or the supernatural, but he's not a physicalist. So he thinks that the physical world is not enough to describe the world. There's a separate set of mental properties that the world has. And this leads him to be something called a panpsychist, where he says even individual electrons have a little tiny bit of consciousness.
This is Leibniz. This is Leibnizian. Monads.
Something like that. And so I think, you know, I just can't go – to me, once you get there, you go like, oh, come on. I've got something terrible has happened here.
Right. It all feels like humans endowing things to help explain stuff as opposed to just taking what is, what you can actually observe. And
I think that's exactly right. I think that the great progress made by people like Einstein was largely involved in Hugh Everett, who invented the many worlds interpretation. A lot of what they did was just therapeutic, not just physical. They said, look, this stuff, you don't need this stuff. We can explain this complicated stuff in terms of a much smaller set of simple stuff.
Isn't science ultimately a higher probability of correctness when it's more elegant? It's Occam's razor.
There are those who disagree, but yes, I think so.
They disagree with Occam's razor?
They do, yeah.
Who?
Yeah. I don't want to speak for anybody else, but there is this in particle physics, right? We've long had this idea of naturalness. Like, we don't know what exactly is going on beyond what we've looked at, but we want it to be natural in some way. We don't want it to be like finely tuned and, you know, if you measure a number and it's 3,
we want it to be
2 plus 1. You don't want it to be a million and 3 minus a million.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You don't want to be something delicately fine tuned like that.
Yeah, we like that. But that may just be us. Okay.
Well, that idea, flimsy as it sounds, was enough to make predictions for the Large Hadron Collider, the big new particle accelerator that we built. And none of those predictions has come true. And we haven't seen anything. It's a real issue for particle physics right now that we haven't had a surprising new experimental result since the 1970s. We've had fun new experimental results.
That's a problem for particle physics?
It is always a problem because physics makes progress when there is an experiment we can't explain.
Oh.
That's where we learn things, right? Our theories are too good. We have the same theories now we had in the 1970s. That's terrible.
But a lot of it is based on avoiding certain questions.
Well, there are foundational questions. Yeah. You know, what happened at the Big Bang? What is the quantum wave function, et cetera? But in terms of give me a model that explains this experimental result, we can do that.
Kepler.
Yeah.
It just sounds like that.
But it still works, right? But then again, when you have – we're in the very strange situation where we have theories that fit all the data and none of us think that these theories are correct. None of us think that they're the final answer.
Right.
That's the easy part to agree on. The hard part is, well, okay, in what direction do you move? You know, what is the right way? And literally billions of dollars rest on how we answer these questions.
And you're – you enjoy philosophy too.
I do.
Your website, by the way, is preposterousuniverse.com. And speaking of philosophy, in what particularly are you interested in? How'd you get into it?
Oh, I was always interested in it. Well, I became interested in science when I was like 10 years old, reading books when I was a kid. I never even really heard of philosophy until I was an undergraduate in college. And I went to Villanova where they forced you to take 3 semesters of philosophy, like it or not. And I loved it from the start. And I ended up getting a philosophy minor.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But mostly actually my favorite parts were political and moral philosophy. And the philosophy of science that I did that I studied then was more like, you know, how do we decide to change our theories, right? Like what is a theory really? And it's okay, that's worth doing, but it's not what caught my attention. What I realized much later when I started getting into trying to understand the early universe and entropy and the arrow of time. The arrow of time.
What does that mean?
Difference between the past and the future.
So biological time sort of.
Biology is biology arises out of it, the arrow of time. But look, you remember the past. You don't remember the future.
Well, but you know, our friend Viscontis would say that the past is an attempt to predict the future. It's just an evolved sensibility to help us survive.
I'm just making the simple point that they're different. The past and the future are different
in
from
our
each
brain.
Other.
In our brain.
In the universe.
Okay. Okay.
Right? Like, forget about our brain.
In physics, I thought they were not that clear.
There are photographs of events that happened in the past.
Yes, there are.
There are no photographs of events that happened in the future.
No, that's different. But the past
is different.
But unless there's eternal recurrence or something.
Entropy increases. You can mix cream and coffee together. You can't unmix them.
Yes. Okay.
Right.
Fair enough.
And so
Again, eternal recurrence still these a possibility.
Are, that's true. But in the last 14 billion years,
you should attach to that idea.
That's right. But so it turns out that this is ultimately – why is this all happening? Why is there an arrow of time? It's because the early universe 14 billion years ago had a very, very low entropy. It was very orderly in some sense. Why is that is a question that scientists should be addressing but don't. They have largely ignored it. The people who pay attention to it are philosophers.
Wait, why it had low
why
entropy?
Why it had a low entropy? Why
I've never seen, really seen philosophers deal with philosophies of science.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a whole group of philosophers of physics who are really physicists who can't get jobs in physics departments.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So what they're doing is just part and parcel of physics. They're just doing it in a kind of way that rubs physicists the wrong way. So I love it. I think it's absolutely crucial and foundational. And so that's
and what are they
I
coming up with
the
in terms
time.
Of the low entropy world?
Well,
universe.
It's again, they're philosophers. They yeah. they really are. So they're the way that I like to put it is they're not the ones to go through for the right theories. They're the ones to go to tell you why your theory is not the right theory. They're very, very good at saying, okay, here is your mistake or here is your logical gap,
yeah.
right? And so for many cosmologists, working cosmologists, people whose job it is to think about the universe, don't know the very basic fundamental fact that the early universe had a low entropy. That's embarrassing.
And
that's
explain
terrible.
Entropy to people so we don't lose everybody.
So entropy is just the disorderliness, the randomness. If you have a deck of cards and it's all in order, that's low entropy because it's organized. Cream and coffee separate from each other are low entropy. And then if you mix them up, shuffle the cards, mix yeah. the cream into the coffee, entropy goes up. And it's way easier to get entropy to go up than to go down. There's a law of nature that says the universe becomes messier, more disorganized over time.
Since the Big Bang.
Since the Big Bang, exactly. And so all of it relies on imagining that we were very, very orderly at the Big Bang.
Gravity's
got to
be involved
years
with that,
ago.
Right?
Gravity
that,
plays a role,
yeah.
but it doesn't help us answer it. Yeah, it makes
right.
it worse, really. The Big Bang was a very special, orderly configuration of stuff. It was very smooth, right? It was very much the same everywhere. And it's absolutely important to understand these foundational conceptual questions that philosophers are good at if physicists want to tackle this respectively.
That's physics. You like moral and political philosophy, so who are you?
Well, I like that too, but I wouldn't, you know, I'm able to do philosophy of physics. I'm not able to do philosophy
but
of –
But who do you like? I'm just curious.
Who do I like? You know, I actually took a class with John Rawls when I was in grad school. And I didn't like him before I took the class and he convinced me I should like him. He was very smart. He's one of the smartest people yeah. I've ever met. These days –
I'm always concerned about Rawls and stuff.
Well, we can talk about that.
I mean if Rawls' philosophy prevailed, one of my AIDS patients should have consumed the entire national GDP in order to save that person. According to Rawls, you say the most vulnerable are the ones you invest in.
Yeah.
The highest to zero ends. I mean, the ends would have been the same. But
no, yeah, Rawls is not a dummy. He knows that. He would not have said get all the GDP
okay.
of all the countries.
Okay.
In fact, he has explicit paragraphs about. I mean, his rules are meant to apply to a society where things are going pretty well and individuals where things are going pretty well. When things are – like I asked him. I said like what if there's a plague or whatever? You know like what if you just need to make some sacrifices? Like, oh yeah, make the sacrifices. Like don't be an idiot. But he does want to only allow for structural inequality when it benefits the least off. That's
right.
his principle. Right. So he's not happy. But he wants to achieve it through taxes. Like he's not a bomb-throwing radical about it. He's
yeah.
very much the – philosophical justification underpinning
but
very
it always
strong
bothers
welfare
me. He's making
state.
Really economic – he's not an economist. He's making sort of economic predictions. And
yeah. Well,
I mean it's lovely but it's like I'm not sure it's right.
It's hard. It's not – I didn't say it was right. That's a whole other level, right? David Hume is probably my favorite old school philosopher. These days people like Sharon Street at NYU who is a moral constructivist – who helps understand how morality is not objectively out there in the world. It's something that we create for ourselves and I think that's the right way to think about it. But philosophers, it's not – I don't want to have the hero philosophers. None of them is perfect, right?
Right.
Physicists have this wonderful lucky situation they're in that even if they're imperfect, they can still invent a perfect theory.
Right.
Like their theory of relativity for what it's trying to do is just perfectly right. It's not the whole story. We can go beyond it but it's exact. It's precise. It's whatever. But philosophy, it's harder. Theories are more – tied to their individual inventors because things are a little bit fuzzier.
There's a lot of ad hominem attacks.
Well, and which is why philosophers study the history of philosophy whereas physicists totally ignore the history of physics. We just need to know the final answer, like not
how
it got
there. Do mathematicians study history of math? They do, don't they?
No, they will tell you when each theorem came about, but they don't really study how it came about. No, that's too much work.
Yeah. One of the best math classes I ever had was a professor that took me through what he thought was Newton's thinking as his calculus developed.
Okay, yeah, that could be.
And it was so sensible. It made everything fit.
Yeah, I mean, most mathematicians have no idea what Newton was thinking.
Yeah.
It's just not
something. He may not have actually developed it. He could have been right.
Yeah, I mean, Newton, the history is independently fascinating. Newton was a terrible, terrible person. He invested in the
South Sea Bubble or something. Yeah. He lost all his money.
Yeah, he lost all his money. Yeah. A friend of mine is writing a book about that, Newton and the South Sea Bubble. But he became, you know, the chancellor of the mint, and he took incredible delight in chasing down counterfeiters and sending them to the gallows.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, denying them pardons and things like that. And he played private investigator, like he skulked around in pubs to get information on people who were counterfeiting at the time. Yeah, and he wrote much more about biblical exegesis than he ever wrote about physics. You know, he would try to interpret revelation.
He was trying to use math to prove some of his biblical stuff.
Yeah, right? He had these apocalyptic predictions for the future. He did alchemy. He was the best physicist in the world in history, but he was also a crazy bad person.
Crazy. I didn't realize. I'm dying to read your friend's book when it comes out. Would you know all that?
There's a previous book he wrote called Newton and the Counterfeiter, which talks about Newton and the mint and his chasing down of the counterfeiters. I mean, Newton helped stabilize Britain's currency, and then he lost all of his own money in the South Sea speculation. Well,
and I think he made it back, and then he lost it again or something.
Something
but he's a human after all. I mean, that's a human brain.
Right. Right. And his theory doesn't depend on him. Like his theory, I can learn Newtonian mechanics without knowing anything about Isaac Newton. It's much harder for me to learn David Hume's theories or John Rawls' theories without studying their thought in particular, right? Because it's harder in philosophy to state what the theory is in perfectly person-independent terms.
Right. Interesting. And Adam Smith have any appeal to you?
Yeah, sure. You know, I actually visited Scotland for the first time a year or two ago and visited Edinburgh and, you know, Adam Smith and David Hume hung out there. Scottish Enlightenment. And I haven't actually read Adam Smith, so I
The reason I bring him up because he was a moral theorist.
He was, absolutely.
That's what he thought he was. Yeah,
that's right.
Like we think of the Wealth of Nations.
Wealth of Nations. Yeah,
yeah.
That's right. I do think that, you know, both Hume and Smith had some proto-Darwinian ideas, which is really, really interesting. You know, in some broad sense, look, capitalism and natural selection are both ways of finding good answers to hard problems.
Right. Right? Markets.
Not by some super smart brain figuring them out, but by a lot of dumb brains doing a lot of dumb things and the wisdom of crowds or the wisdom of genetic drift and mutations.
And millions of thousands.
Gets us there.
Small maneuvers.
They're mostly failures and, you know, you find interesting good solutions. And in both cases, bad things can happen and good things can happen and it's complicated. But that intellectual history is fascinating.
And some that people miss is that evolution was in the vapor since the Greeks.
Yeah.
And there was Lamarckian evolution was very popular before. We just didn't have a mechanism for evolution until Darwin came around.
Yeah, and even Darwin didn't know about genes, right? So even he didn't really know.
He had I'm blanking on everybody's name right now, the sweet pea.
No, he didn't.
Mendel. He had Mendel, but he had it on his desk for like 4 years before he found it. Yeah.
But no, Mendel didn't publish until after Darwin did.
I think it was a letter that he
sent. Oh, he could have had a letter. That's
possible. But it was right like there the whole time.
But Mendel was pretty ignored. Like he, you know, we give him credit afterward. I know this because Villanova, where I was an undergraduate, it was a Catholic university, but it was not Jesuit, like almost all Catholic universities are. It was Augustinians.
Oh.
And the only two famous Augustinians are Martin Luther, who they don't like to brag about, and Gregor Mendel. He was an Augustinian monk, so they're very proud of him.
I got to write my note to my wife right now because she interrupts everything. But there we go. She knows when I'm podcasting. St. Augustine is another really super interesting guy.
Sure.
Have you ever read his his autobiography?
I've read parts of it. You know, he wrote a lot about time. He wrote a lot about the nature of time. He has this joke where he says it's funny because he can't resist telling the joke, but then he says, I feel bad for telling it. It's a joke that says someone asks me I forget the joke. It's like someone asks me what is time and I say I don't know, but Yeah, I'm forgetting the joke. Sorry, it's like God was creating hell for people who ask such questions.
Oh,
or something
yeah,
like that.
Right.
That
makes sense.
I'm forgetting the setup. Sorry.
Such a smart guy. He was an alcoholic sex addict.
Originally,
and,
yes.
Yeah.
That's why his book is called The Confessions.
And his Confessions is like the first big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's all the same stuff that's in the big book, just not quite as explicitly expressed, and has a whole different – goes down quite a different path eventually. But it's interesting to me. I read that. I was like, oh my God, this guy's alcoholic straight up.
All these people are fascinating. Lucretius, who is a Roman poet, was one of the people who was an atomist, right? So he believed in atoms, but it's 2,000 years ago. He didn't know anything about atoms.
Yeah.
But he wrote this whole long poem about the creation of the universe and how the laws of physics work, and sort of prefigured both Darwin and quantum mechanics in weird ways. And it's just amazing.
Yeah. We had these intuitions around. They just never got really fully crystallized.
Well, because we didn't have science. We didn't have a way to sort of test these ideas, and it took a long time.
Now, another topic. In one of your pods, you were talking about your criticism of the dark web.
Yes, that's
and
right.
You're kind of in that zone here with us.
Kroll is
sort of the dark web.
All right.
And
we should say the intellectual dark
intellectual
web, not just
dark web,
the you know, selling drugs and
Jordan
guns.
Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris, something like that. And I'm a fan of all those guys. I'm a fan of you. And you missed something, I thought, in your analysis of the dark web that I wanted to kind of discuss with you.
Sure.
Which was you took the position that there was a preference to – let's just pick a topic that they talk – let's say Sam Harris talks about. He'll talk about biological difference between men and women. And there's a preference to either amplify or point out those differences in the dark web. And I disagree in the strongest terms. It's a preference for nothing other than discussing the truth. So if we want equality, we have to look at these differences to figure out how to get them towards equality, which is a very different thing than amplifying or preferring one or the other.
Yeah. So two things. One is, and I probably did this badly myself, but my topic in the podcast was not the intellectual dark
web. I know.
It was morality and rationality, and I thought it would be helpful to focus the mind to pick an example of people I disagreed with, right?
Yeah.
And so I picked vegans on the one hand and the IDW on the other hand. Just so people know if they want to listen to the podcast.
It's a good podcast.
You know, the other one, so we very much disagree. I think that what you just said, that we should all talk about everything and get to the truth and so forth.
And be cautiously, because science has been used to do great harm to people,
absolutely.
Right? We all acknowledge that.
Yeah, that's right.
It's done bad things, but to deny the truth takes away something that can help us get to a better place.
And I agree with that, and most everyone would agree with that. And yet I never hear people in the intellectual dark web.
Sam does that.
I never hear people talk, emphasizing the fact that women are really discriminated against in science, and that's a huge problem.
Huge problem.
Yeah, and I just never hear rants about that on the side of the IDW.
Probably because I'm thinking of Sam particularly, and because he spent so much time defending himself.
Well, Sam is my favorite member of the IDW. Yeah. I should put it that way. Like of the ones I'm familiar with, which I'm not very much, but I'm closest to him.
Yeah.
And that's why I pick on him especially, because others I'm just going to say like, oh my God, what are you doing?
You
but Sam,
them.
I want to treat with respect because I want to engage with him. I've been on his.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I got to go find him now.
So I think that maybe it's out there. I don't know. I've heard
because I'm concerned whenever the truth is pushed aside.
Yeah, sure.
People
of course.
Look at the truth. It's 100% very concerning.
In favor of that.
Very concerning.
So my point in the podcast was: of course, we want the truth. Of course, we should be able to talk about everything. I want to be as pro free speech as anybody. But when we sit there and pretend to be as unbiased as we can be, it's crucially important to sit back and think, are we really being unbiased?
Oh,
like,
of course.
How are there secretly biases sneaking in here?
Oh, of
and
course.
And whenever I hear people talk about the example I know most about and therefore I talk most about is women in science.
Yeah.
People say incredibly stupid things
about
women in science because they get to a place which sounds plausible and makes them feel kind of comfortable. It makes them feel like, well, people like me aren't really discriminating. There's just some fundamental difference between who we are, and then they stop thinking. And I have not seen any IDW-led discussions that overturn that particular misconception. I would love to see it. Maybe it's out there and I just don't know about it.
Well, I don't think – the fact that it has not been a priority is a tell. Interesting. And personally, I know I've been really trying to be very careful and responsible around race for myself, and I've done a lot of reading history now And I'm shocked at how ignorant I was on so much stuff. It's shocking. Yeah, there's... When you really start to pay attention, it is shocking.
Right.
If it's not your lived experience, you're having a
different experience. And Sam, again, I'll criticize Sam because he's the one I like the most.
Yeah.
Okay. He famously had Charles Murray on his podcast.
But
and
he claimed.
Let me finish.
Please do.
And he will say, look, we should be talking to everybody. And so that's fine. He won't have Ta-Nehisi Coates on the podcast.
Who's that?
He's a black writer for The Atlantic. He wrote The Case for Reparations.
Why won't he have him?
Because he's too ideological and too wedded to identity politics.
Hmm. That's interesting. Is it more just to maybe attack Sam in writing or something?
I don't think so. I think that – so I disagree with the idea that in practice, members of the IDW are – just unbiasedly looking for the truth. I think that they're human beings.
Right. Everyone's
exactly.
biased. Yeah.
They're human beings like the rest of us.
I think you have the highest probability of success in Sam in terms of raising his cognitive
exactly.
biases.
That's right.
Because he's a scientist and that's your job is to try to pay attention to your bias.
Well, he's human and he's been criticized and, he sometimes says things.
He's defensive.
He's a wonderful writer and sometimes that can get away from you and you can be a little bit more dramatic than you should be. Mm. And like any human being, when he's criticized for that, his first instinct is to double down and defend himself, right? And like I have that instinct too. Mm. But I do try to say – here's a hot take for you. I love Twitter because Twitter will call you on your shit. It will call you on perfectly good things you say too, right?
Yes, right.
But I love it because I really do know that I have biases and I say things and sometimes those things I think are perfectly obvious and the Twitter mobs come out and say, that's not really obvious at all in much less polite terms.
Yes,
okay?
Yes.
And at least I will sit back and think, well, did I get that wrong? Is that obvious that I – and I try to resist this doubling down impulse. And that's why
you got to stop, take a deep breath and look at yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so that's why I in the podcast emphasize the fact that this is to me what it means to be an intellectual. Richard Feynman said you should always try not to fool yourself and you're the easiest one to fool, right?
Great quote.
And it's easy to say that, easy to say we should be unbiased, blah, 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 blah. It's so hard to do that.
You have to really understand all the different – kinds of biases you're
absolutely
affected by.
And I say at the end, look, couldn't there also be biases that say, if I'm a member of a minority group, isn't there a bias to sort of self-righteously say I'm oppressed and I'm discriminated against and that's why I'm not succeeding? Yeah, that's a huge bias and that's one you should also look out for. But the whole group of people who get the label of social justice warriors. Mm. I don't want to call them my enemies. Mm. I might disagree with them about letting a certain Nazi give a talk on campus. I think that even Nazis should be able to give a talk on campus.
Sure. Yeah.
But we disagree on strategy, not on goals.
How are things at Caltech? Is there much going on there?
Caltech, they just worry about getting the problem sets done.
Well, I was going to say that's usually in STEM classes, even on college campuses with a lot of activity, the STEM students are busy doing their problem sets, bottom line.
Yeah, but most students on most campuses are busy doing their problem sets.
My daughter went to Columbia and there's a lot of other stuff going on.
There's a lot of other stuff going on. There's a lot of stuff on both sides, right? On all sides. Jeffrey Sachs, if you follow him on Twitter, does a wonderful job of, looking at the numbers for there's a lot of violations of free speech and free association and things like that. But there's not an ideological tilt to them. They go both ways, but there is an ideological tilt to how much they are talked about online. And often, there's institutional – so I guess this – part of what I try to make in my podcast is of course we should all say let's not be biased, right? But let's admit that one of the biggest biases is some sort of conservatism in the classic sense of standing up for the status quo. It's how we were raised. Like if you think that society it has been historically racist and sexist, then even if you don't believe it's true now, you just believe, 50 years ago there was sexism, but now there's not, right?
Yeah.
oh, come on, because the people who were born 50 years ago are still alive and they grew up in a racist society, even if you don't think that you're racist.
If you study history, you can't escape certain –
You can't escape it. And so
– That's the problem. People are not studying history.
Your default should be to think, you know, I totally could be racist. Like, I don't want to be. I try not to be. If I'm conscious and cognitive about it, I'm not. But maybe inside me there's something going on and I should be aware of that. And every time someone says, you know, that was a little bit racist, that thing you did or said, rather than the obvious human response, which is to say, what, me? I'm not racist. I would never do that. Yeah. Some of my best friends are
I actually think we need to come up with a little different language, that like a soft version of white supremacy. Like, because white perspectivalism or something, because you have your own perspectivalism and that history that came with you.
And social epistemology.
I like it.
Social epistemology is the philosophical –
Only you and I will adopt it.
No, it exists.
But go ahead.
It already exists. Yeah. It's the idea that when you try to learn things and know – epistemology is the study of knowledge, how we learn and know things. Yeah. And social epistemology is just a recognition of the fact that we do that. As we said, you know, brains and consciousnesses are embodied and located in the world. So is our search for knowledge. You know, we come from a perspective. And the way that I put it in the podcast was – I actually said this. I forgot to link it, but I mentioned this in my very first podcast, my sort of teaser a year ago for the podcast, the fact that there's an infinite number of facts around us and we choose to focus on some things and ignore other things. Okay? We can't help that. It's not
a
flaw.
It's the way it works.
It's not even optional, right? Like there's an infinite number of facts. We can't pay attention to all of them equally.
You can imagine a world where there was a brain that attended that, but not our world.
But so – we have a filter. We look at some things, we ignore other things, and we can think that we're being totally fair because in the things that we look at, we're judging them totally fairly. And there's a whole bunch of things sort of like buzzing in the background.
Yeah, we're not even
noticing. We've chosen not to notice. Yeah. And I think that that's just as, you know, given that I am a straight, white, heterosexual guy, I need to make an extra effort to see outside that particular perspective.
Personally, I believe that effort includes reading your history.
Oh, absolutely. Of course.
Because very few of us do it these days.
No.
Especially American history.
And if you don't read it, then at least listen to good podcasts.
Which there are plenty right now. But you really need to think about what certain groups have experienced and really what went on here. I was reading I'm going to have to wrap this up in a minute. I could talk to you. I knew I'd be able to – I want to talk to you for two podcasts, but I don't have that. And I appreciate you being here.
I'm a local.
Well, I'll have you back. Trust me, because I live in Pasadena. So, you know –
and Echo Park.
Close up. And you go to work in Pasadena, don't you? All right.
Just let me quickly mention, as I said in the podcast, speaking of history, I was reading the biography or some biographical notes of Vera Rubin, who's a famous astronomer. Mm. And she applied to graduate school in astronomy various places. And Princeton, for example, rejected her outright because they just didn't accept women.
You brought this up on the podcast.
And, exactly. Yeah. So I thought about that. Really? Princeton didn't accept graduate students in physics who are women in the 1960s?
Amherst College.
They didn't accept undergraduate women in the 1960s.
I was the first co-ed class in Amherst College
in
1980. Think about that.
This is our lives.
It's in our backyard.
Yeah.
And we pretend it's 1,000 years ago or never happened.
I'm agreeing with you. It's like the history is – there's no – and my wife Jennifer, who is a writer by trade and learned science later, whereas I'm a scientist and learned writing later, she's always on me about – turning things into stories, telling the human part of it because – and actually, ironically enough, scientific studies have shown that if you want to convince somebody of something, you can throw all the facts at them you want.
Yeah, narratives.
Narratives.
Relatable source. Be emotionality.
Relatable, be friendly. Yeah, you know? We're
flawed. I know. I'm busy always trying to affect behavior and I know the information goes – that you can teach all the information you want. Does not affect behavior very much at all, which I find bizarre. But I was going to say the Grant biography opened my eyes so much to the post-Civil War period that we have erased. African-Americans have been reminding us about it, but the Americans, the history, they tried to erase it. And I've been studying that kind of deeply lately and I am just mortified that that isn't part of my – hasn't been part of my consciousness my whole life.
Yeah, sure. I mean,
mortified.
I lived in Chicago for 7 years and I loved the city and it's obviously one of the most segregated cities in the United States. And you can literally see how it's segregated by like where the freeways are and it didn't just happen organically, right? This was a policy to make this happen. And certain neighborhoods just don't get the resources.
You know, as Pasadena's got a similar problem.
Oh yeah, you know.
But I did a lot of work with the African American community. They're serving medical needs up there, and I had a lot of patients in the 90s. No, it was actually the 80s, who were here at the turn of the century, the 20th century, and they said, "Look, hey, in Pasadena, there were just two types of people. There were the rich people and the people who worked for the rich people, and that was it. That's all that lived in Pasadena at the time." And all the geography and all the development since is all a reflection of that original settlement.
When I went to college at Villanova, there was either mansions or these little tiny streets with tiny houses. You're so like, what were those?
Crazy.
And like, that's where the servants lived.
Again,
yeah.
If you think our economic stuff is bad now, look at history and look at how we've gotten out of it, how we've improved it.
I know that, you know, Princeton owns Albert Einstein's house where he used to live, or the Institute of Advanced Study does. So I asked when I moved to Caltech, I said, like, where's Richard Feynman's house?
Yeah.
And I was told, like, Richard Feynman moved here in the 1950s. You don't think they let Jews live in Pasadena in the 1950s, did you?
They did, but they weren't allowed to be along one of the clubs or anything else, and they had to be in the outskirts and then keep their mouth shut and that kind of stuff. Yeah.
It's not that long ago. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
All right. So we got to wrap. But again, what do you got coming on podcast?
I'm not supposed to tell you that, but they're so good.
More on quantum mechanics.
Yeah, so I have –
But relatable quantum mechanics. That's what I'm going to give people the sense of.
I have one on the history of quantum mechanics, and I have one – that would be very relatable, easy to understand, fun history, right? And I have one solo episode, me just spouting off my ideas about quantum gravity.
Quantum gravity?
Where gravity
still
comes from.
Many world
quantum
stuff?
Mechanics. Yeah, that's right.
You just lose me in the many world thing, because as soon as you say infinity, I just think one.
Yeah, that's okay.
You know what I mean?
I'll just tell you. I have an interview with Seth MacFarlane coming up about science fiction and the Orville.
Fantastic. Did you go to him or you come to you? Or?
I went to him, but
he's an old friend. He's the greatest guy. Did you have fun?
Super fun.
Did he have his JD there at the table while he was talking?
No, he did mention it.
Has Seth been in here in recent years?
Gary? Did you say has Seth been in here in my years?
In recent years?
Not in recent years, but he's been here since I've been here.
Yeah. But we talk about, we didn't talk about like Family Guy or anything like that. It was all about the Orville, which I think is a fantastic show, and about how he uses science fiction to explore very contemporary ideas.
He's a super bright guy, and he deserves all the success he's gotten.
So this is just to point out, I have very esoteric sciencey ones. I have one on panpsychism. Coming up. But I also have one, on politics and
religion. School have any issues with you doing the pods?
No, they don't care. They don't like it, but they can't stop me.
it's weird to me that schools are not specifically invested in
– No. It hurts your career if you do things like this. Write books, do podcasts.
That's insanity, number one, on the intellectual side, but also from the school side. Some of their mission should be to push information to the world, to educate the world. And they go the other way. It's like, hey, you got to pay to come here to get the information. You apply here.
Caltech of all the institutions of higher education in Southern California has the highest reputation.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It has an outsized leverage to reach out to the public and make a difference. Yep. And it doesn't try. It's just not interested.
The city of Pasadena barely knows it's there.
Yeah.
That I find that astonishing.
Yeah.
How about the fact there's a significant medical center right down the street? No relation with Caltech.
No.
That should be going on all the time. It's just insanity.
Yeah. Well, I'm not the boss of the world, so I can't fix all these things. But there's a self-perpetuating thing where if you are interested in these things, maybe it's changing a little bit. But if you're interested in not only doing science research but also doing outreach, talking to the general public and so forth.
I think it's part of the responsibility. Part of the necessary
– It's not everyone's responsibility because some people are really bad at it.
No, but I mean
as a field –
institution's responsibility.
Yes, that's right.
They used to be this thing called iTunes U where they put up lectures and stuff. And I used to just devour that. And they started going, no, there's a liability here and people should be paying and blah, 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 blah. Whatever. You have a series, don't you, on the great courses?
I have a couple courses on the great courses, three of them, one on dark matter, one on the Higgs boson, and one on the arrow of time.
Well, I got to get the arrow of time. Yeah. I guess time fascinates me.
Well, that was my first book, which was From Eternity to Here on the arrow of time. Yeah.
Give me a sketch. What am I going to learn?
What is entropy? Why does it increase? What does that mean about the future of the universe?
Is time about entropy?
The fact that the past is different from the future is all about entropy.
And
the fact that time has an arrow is because of
time is entropy. A dimension, though.
Time is a dimension. So just like space
is a dimension.
time didn't need to have an arrow. Space doesn't have an arrow, right? But if you're here in this room, space does have an arrow. The difference between up and down,
yeah.
right? But you don't think that's a fundamental part of the laws of physics. You know it's because the Earth is right beneath you.
Yeah.
So the major realization is the fact that time has a direction isn't part of the fundamental laws of physics. It's because the Big Bang is before you.
I'm going to give that some thought.
Yeah.
This is my friend. Thank you so much for being on here. I appreciate spending all this time with us. It's Sean Carroll, Trent Scarrow, Mindscape. Go do it now. Download it. Also the book, Something Deeply Hidden, Quantum World and the Emergence of Space-Time. And I hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
See you next time.
For call-in times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's D-R-D-R-E-W Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the Swingin' Sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or drdrew.com.